Hello, my friends, and thanks for joining me again here on the Grief Observe podcast. I'm your host, Brad Morrell. And if you want to be on the podcast to tell your story of grief, please contact me at griefobservedpodcast@gmail.com or find me on Facebook at facebook.com/griefobservedpodcast. I think I've got a good show lined up today, and it's going to be a little bit different than the norm. And one that I hope that we'll maybe look at grief and death in kind of a completely different perspective than what's typical of our normal episodes here. Today, my guest is Carrie Northey, otherwise known on social media as Carrie the Mortician. She is a licensed funeral director, a business consultant, embalmer, influencer, and educator. And I've been looking forward to this episode, and here we are. I have tons of questions, so we'll get rolling here. Carrie, it's nice to meet you, and thank you for joining me.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. It's like I said, normally what I have, I started out wanting to just have voices of real people, real life, real situations come on and speak about their grief journey and just talk to just listeners to say, hey, you're not alone through this. So I have been branching out a little bit. I've had some authors. I've had some other therapists online. And you are my first mortician. So
yay!
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So I like I said, I've got tons of questions. I've watched several of your videos, even this morning. And I don't know. Why don't you just first tell us a little bit about Carrie.
Yeah. So I am in Michigan, Southwest Michigan. I'm born, raised, been here pretty much except for going away for mortuary school to Cincinnati and came back. And I am a part-time single mom and raising my two little girls. And I've been a licensed funeral director for 22 years. I've been in the business almost 30 years. So this is my life, my life's work up to this point. So I don't know much different than being around death, and not so much death, because I've never seen anybody die, but being around the dead and the grieving and those who have just had a loss. So,
yeah, that's interesting for you to say you've never seen anyone die, and being a mortician. I don't know. That's interesting. Yeah,
I think so too. Only my dog being put to sleep about 4.5 years ago, it's the only time I've witnessed a death, which is, yeah, it is odd, I think, to me, to not have seen that part of it.
So one of the things that I noticed in one of the videos I watched today was kind of your come to mortician type of story.
Yeah.
And it included a lot of vacuuming back in the old days. So I think your mom worked at a funeral home. Is that right?
She did. So when I was 16, and it's time to go to work. If you want a car, you have to pay for things. And so my mom was aftercare coordinator, which meant she did the follow up with families and tried to but as part of it, you circle people back into pre-need. So you want this perfect circle of pre-need, at-need, aftercare, pre-need. So you want to keep people in your loop. And so she would do some kind of support group stuff. She would be with families during viewings when they first came in to view their loved one. She would help them with things after. She taught women how to pump gas that had made me never pump gas when their after their husbands died. So, you know, 70, 80-year-old women that had never done these things, or a man writing a check because his, you know, wife always wrote all the bills and checks, and she would sit or help them clean out closets when they were ready to get rid of clothing and things. So she did a lot of random things with people, but they're normal tasks, especially in a marriage or in a specific relationship role that maybe one person did something all the time and really has no idea. And so she was a support person for them to do those things. And so she said, why don't you work at the funeral home? I said, okay, whatever, sure. And, you know, at the time, making $3 an hour and thought that was awesome. So I would work the evening shift. It was back when there were pagers, and funeral directors in small towns to get away from the funeral home had to have a babysitter for the phones, essentially. So a lot of little old ladies would come sit at the funeral home till late at night and, you know, miss Mrs. Smith or whoever and answer phones until 8, 9 at night. So then the funeral director would get home in the evening later after maybe going to a kid's school activity or something, and then they would take the phones for the night. So I worked in the evening till 9. I'd work a 6-hour shift on the weekends because there was 9 to 9, always someone in the funeral home every day. And that just gave the funeral director relief. So that's kind of where I started working visitations, working funerals on the weekends, setting up chairs, breaking down chairs, setting up chairs, breaking down chairs. And we stored our chairs upstairs. So I had to go upstairs with like 50 stacks of chairs and then back downstairs the next day. And a lot of vacuuming. There's still in every funeral home is a lot of vacuuming. So a lot of redundant tasks back when typewriters were used for everything. And so a lot of typing. And so learned skills that I think some people never learned as teenagers, even back in the 90s, doing those things. But that's kind of how I got started in, you know, an office, a caretaking sort of way at the funeral home.
Yeah. So I saw also that you had several different career choices, or you really didn't know what you wanted to do when you were going through college, I guess. And I think you even tapped into a little bit of psychology, which kind of tickled my heart. So how did you land in this field?
Yeah. So when I went to a small liberal arts college here in Michigan, and I was going to study biology and be an epidemiologist. I wanted to hunt diseases and stuff. Well, chemistry, biology, math, not my strong suit. And that's what epidemiology is statistics, which I didn't know. You know, I thought I was running around the country in a Tyvek suit, like the movie Outbreak, tracking down Ebola every week. But that's not exactly what you do as an epidemiologist. So I stepped back and tried to figure out what do I like, what interests me. And I love psychology. I love, you know, the study of human behavior and such. So I went into psychology and got my bachelor's degree in psychology. And in my junior year, trying to figure out what do I want to do next, you know, with just a general psych degree, not a lot of opportunity. It's really a degree you need to go on to maybe do something else with it. And my mom and I had a conversation and she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I love forensic psychology. I love study of serial killers and that mind and kind of, you know, Mindhunter, the movie, like sign me up for the FBI or something. And it was too many more years of college. I'm not an in-seat learner. That's not my strong suit. And she said, well, what about funeral directing? And I said, you know, and so, well, why don't you try it? And so at that time, I could do my apprenticeship before going off to mortuary school. Every state, that's not a possibility. So after my junior year, I did a summer of my apprenticeship, and it didn't take but maybe 2-3 weeks in. And I was like, all right, she was right. Mom was right. And I had found kind of my place. And so I shifted everything towards that. I had to line up all of my prerequisites for mortuary school. So my senior year of my first college was getting all of them in place, because it's a little all over the board. You have to have a chemistry, a public speaking, a math, a psychology, anatomy, all these different classes that you have to do because you wear so many different hats as a funeral director. So I really had to try and get those all in before I went to school after my senior year, which was good. And then graduated and headed off to mortuary school and finished my apprenticeship after my senior year. So I split it between 2 summers, which you could do at that point. And it was only 6 months because I had a bachelor's degree. So it was a shorter apprenticeship. It worked well for me going off to school. I had a lot of experience going in, which is not the norm now for students. And so it was kind of nice having that experience heading off to school. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've told people on this podcast before, years ago, I actually wanted to do your job. Like when I was in 10th, 11th grade, that was like what I wanted to do. And for whatever reason, I just didn't want to leave home at that time. And I don't know what the rules are now here in Tennessee, but at that time, I think you had to do 1 year apprenticeship and 1 year of school, which the closest schools were Nashville or Atlanta. And yeah. I didn't want to move away from home. And then ironically, I'd go off to the Navy, you know, go figure. So maybe it just wasn't for me. One thing that I saw on your website that I found very interesting, one of your little taglines there is cultivating change in the death care industry. What do you think you need to do or want to do or want to see changed in the funeral care industry?
Oh, there's so much. I think my biggest, which it's funny because I just had this conversation again the other day, that it would be wonderful if every state was on the same platform in terms of laws and regulations and rules, that it was not so much it was a federal thing, but that every state just went by the same regulations. Because I teach for a mortuary school, and the class I teach, you know, we talk about things and I'm like, you have to figure out the laws in your state because I have no idea. And some states you can get a license as a funeral director, but not an embalmer. Some states you can get a dual license. So that's different across the board. Just all sorts of different little nuances that are different between states. And so to not know with another state, if someone reaches out and asks me a question, I have to then go do a deep dive about their state and figure it out. Whereas it would be great if we just generally knew what the answers were for every state because they were all the same. That's challenging. And that would be something I would love to have changed, but that would be, I think, such an Everest of task to undertake to try and have that happen. I just don't know that that will ever, unless government steps in and says, this is what's happening, everybody get on board kind of thing. But it would be awesome if it was, and if dispositions that are available were just automatically legal in every state, they could go through one hoop jump rather than one for every state for like alkaline hydrolysis or terramation, and that just automatically it would roll out to each state all at the same time would be amazing.
Let me give you some hope there, Carrie. In my field as a licensed professional counselor, they have started a process here in the last year and a half called the Counseling Compact. And it's something that has not completely taken form yet. They're in process, but pretty soon I will be able to counsel in a multitude of states. And it's up to each state to sign on board. Some states are still going through legislation processes. Some states have already signed off, and it's just once the Counseling Compact is in true effect, then we'll be able to branch out. And a lot of it is, like you're stating, the standards of one state may be way higher than another. Some of the things that I've seen in the funeral business is, for example, it seems like Colorado is the state, or Colorado, depending on how you pronounce that, is like the one state that seems to, like, you don't even have to have a license, do you?
You do not right now. Right. That's changing. After some of the situations that have come up out there, like Return to Nature Funeral Home, that they found 190 bodies that have been there for up to 7 years and such, and the mom and daughter team that sold body parts a couple years ago, there have been some really big situations because there is no regulation in terms of licensure. And so that has become a forefront now that they are working very quickly on making some regulations. There is a licensed funeral or mortuary school in Colorado. You can get your license, but you do not have to. You can literally wake up one day and say, I want to be an embalmer today, and just be an embalmer. And so that's a scary, scary thing. And I think right now they're putting all of those stories at the forefront to really try and focus on Colorado, whereas there are some bad things happening in other states too. Not near as bad as Return to Home. That's, they're taking the cake on that one. But there are a lot of bad things that people do, unfortunately, in every industry. And sure, the funeral business is exceptionally, I think, bad because it deals with human. It deals with, you know, loved ones and things. And so there's always going to be an emotional component to stories when it comes to funeral homes. So
Yeah, I know you had one loss that you speak of on social media quite often, and I'd like to touch into that because I think some misconceptions, and maybe we'll go there as well for you, but I think some misconceptions are that funeral directors or embalmers just have this you're emotionless, we'll say, you know, and you know, some of the stories that you've told about someone in your life show that that's not the case. So, I don't know. Are you okay about speaking about the loss of your niece?
I sure am. Yeah.
Yeah. So, tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Yeah. So back in 2008, my niece was 7 at the time, which I seem to never say her age when I tell and talk about her death. And she was killed in a murder-suicide by her father down in Ohio. My sister and him were divorced at the time, and she was with him for their weekend. And when she went for pickup, nobody answered the door. So she gave it plenty of time and then called the police, and they went in and found them. Me and my brother and my mom and dad knew something was hinky, so we had already started in motion to get down there. It was one of those things, it wasn't a shock, but it was a surprise at the time. We always felt that he was building towards something. He was not a great person. He was very mentally ill. But to our system is very hard when it comes to things and trying to get children out of situations that are not always safe. And
Yes.
that it was a very prime example of that, where there was clear indications, but it was hard. And he was a youth pastor. He worked for United Way. He was on paper this, perfect individual, on paper. And that's, I think, a very narcissistic way of, I am going to present perfectly, but I have my demons. And that's how he was. So he had killed her, and we all went down. And right away, when my mom called me to say they found her, she's dead, in the same breath as where I as how I remember it, it may not have been, she said, "Your sister wants you to take care of her." So I had 1 second of being an aunt and then was the funeral director. So
Wow.
when you get put on the other side of the table, which is kind of how we refer when you have your own loss, it is our defense mechanism, I think, to go into funeral director mode anyway. That's how we know how to deal with death, is funeral director mode. So if anybody around us dies, we want to know how we can help in that capacity a lot of times. And so it is hard to turn that role off and turn on any normal emotion, because not that we don't feel, just that we do have some blinders on to some of the impact of death, I think, in a lot of ways. So to navigate through is hard. And so immediately I became funeral director Carrie and started coming up with a plan. But at this point, it was middle of the night. I mean, I think we arrived to her house about 5 a.m. So there was nothing we could do during the course of the night. There was nothing action we could do. There's nobody to call. And so one morning came, the big question was, what is her condition? How does she look? So I immediately called the medical examiner's office and said, "I'm going to be taking care of her. Can you give me any indication?" And they gave me a few things, ideas. But as we have found as funeral directors over the years, medical examiner's office doesn't always have the clearest indication of viewability and condition, because they're not washing people off to see what's really under blood or dirt or whatever may be there. So a bath is always the first thing, because then you can clearly see what injury is there and what your viewability, where they don't see past that sometimes. So it's always good for us to make our own determination once they're in our care. But yeah, so that was kind of what happened. And we knew we wanted to bring her back to Michigan, so I had to find a funeral home down there where I could go embalm and under the supervision of an Ohio licensee, because I'm not unlicensed in Ohio. So I had to find someone to give me professional courtesy to let me in. to do that and to work alongside me. And then we were driving her back to Michigan, and I drove her back myself in my car and with my sister. We rode together and then had a funeral home back here already lined up we were going to work with, and kind of all went from there.
You know, that's one thing I found interesting in one of your videos was the fact that you were telling people that they can transport their own loved one as long as they have permission. Is that
correct?
Did I take that right? Okay.
Right. So you can't, like, let's say your mom dies in Indiana. You can't just put her in the car and drive her up to Michigan. You have to have a funeral home in Indiana or a licensed director in Indiana that has a transfer permit for you to bring your mom up to Michigan, or vice versa. There is very few states where you have to embalm to cross state lines. And so that is not something the majority of people need to worry about. You can cross state lines without being embalmed. You can fly on a plane without being embalmed. You can, like, there's a, you know, there's a lot of the misconceptions are not, are just that, they're misconceptions. But yes, you can place your loved one in your vehicle and drive them where they need to get to. So that's what I did. And we had her just wrapped up in the back of my yellow Saturn View. Looks like a little mini school bus. And when my sister and her would go between Ohio and Michigan, because every time she had her, they would come back to Michigan. And they would always drive through the same Taco Bell in the same city. And so we went through that Taco Bell with her wrapped up in the back seat. So we laughed so much because we're like, if these people only knew what they who they were serving. And that's one thing that is okay to happen, is you can get slap happy, you can make jokes, you can laugh. Our bodies respond and our minds respond the way they need to in grief. So I will sit with families at the funeral home and we will laugh and tell jokes, and it's okay, because that's, you meet the people where they're at. And if they're completely somber, you're there. If they're kind of laughing, joking, you meet them there, because that's what they need right then. And it's okay to do that, whether it's tears or laughter, it's okay to respond those ways. So we were pretty slap happy at that point, and we were running on no sleep almost, because this all transpired. We got there at 5 a.m. We were there a whole day before she was released. And then the next day when she was released, I went right to the funeral home. And so within less than 48 hours, we were on the road with her back to Michigan. And I had gone to the home, I had gone to see where she was killed, and see if there's anything we needed. And, you know, so there was a lot of things that I did and wanted to do. I think it was good for me to kind of walk through some of that. And the only thing I regret is not seeing him dead. And I wish I would have asked the question, which they would have told me no, I'm sure, but I wish I would have seen him dead. That's my only regret in the whole process, is that.
Yeah, you speak about closure, and that is a different type of closure, right? That this person has harmed someone that you loved.
Yeah.
Or love, and you want some form of closure, I guess, to see that he is gone.
I don't think it's closure at all. That word, okay. That word kind of bothers me, because you never close out a part of any of it. But
sure.
To acceptance, I think might be a better, like, 100% understanding of what has happened. And so I will still see people and I will stare at them like, what if that's really him? You know, like with a not 100% certainty that he was really, really dead, because I didn't see him. So that's why I don't understand people who never see their loved one after they've died. They never see them dead. So I'm like, how can you 100% with certainty ever have some peace about that they are for sure gone if you've never seen them? So I am such a believer and advocate for viewing, for something, for just briefly seeing them if at all possible. And so, and I can say that because of my own experience. I just know that that was one of my regrets, and I don't regret a lot in life. And that is one regret that I think I have, because I wish I would have done that. But at my niece's funeral, we talked about, and when I got up and spoke, we talked about forgiveness and not carrying anger and forgiving him and forgiving his family, because it did nothing for us to be angry at him. There was nothing more we could do, you know, because he was gone. And so it just, we had to move forward. But it was a slow, in terms of, I think, grief and feeling things, it was a very slow, long for me to let a lot of emotion in. And a lot came out in the years after that I think couldn't be present in the beginning because of caring for her and being the funeral director role person. And so I think as funeral professionals, we grieve in such a broken way that can do such detriment to us, because it's really hard to navigate some of that.
You know, you're talking about, you feel like it is important at least to view someone at least briefly. And I know in some of your videos, you know, I guess people have asked you, you know, cremate or burial, things of that nature. I'll have to tell you what my wife said. This is kind of funny. A while back, I asked her, I said, it's been a while since we've had that conversation. Do you want to be cremated or buried? And she said, I don't know. Surprise me. So, yeah, but I feel like it would be extremely important for me to see her, you know, if she had passed away. Like and I see that being an important part. I'm curious, have there been times where you have either cautioned a family or stated that it's probably not a good idea to view a body?
Definitely. And some of it was when I was younger and not as experienced. I'm always growing, always learning. You're never at the top of your game ever, but I definitely have more skills now than I would have in those first 10 years of being licensed, that I guided people away from a viewing, where now I know what I could do, or I have more skill to do it. Or I know better options. You know, if someone is missing a head by it being so destructed and they don't want you to put in the time to do restoration, you can wrap that area and you can have them view the person's hands and things. Hands are very unique, just like anything. And so, you know, it's your loved one by at least doing that, which I've always offered at least that, but some reconstruction I know I could do now. Even looking at my niece, I know I could have her looking way better than she did, even though she looked good. I know I could have her looking way better. And, you know, some of that skill that I just don't know that was there. There's situations where advanced decomposition, where it's just not an option sometimes to do a view because of the smell. You can't even bring them in the building. They can view them in the garage if they want, or via picture. But in the beginning, I think we try to protect families almost too much, where we need to let them kind of decide for themselves sometimes what they want to view and what they don't want to view. And they can sign a release and a waiver that, you know, they understand the situation, but they still want to be there to view. And some of that needs to be up to them, not as much on us, because that's their loved one, that's their right. And it's also their right to switch funeral homes. If you do not allow them to view their loved one, they can go to a different funeral home. I just had a girl tell me that she never got to see her brother after he overdosed because he was their care center. There was multiple people in it, and they would not offer her to bring him to another space for her to view him. So she never got to view him. And that just breaks my heart that there's no reason for that except a bit of laziness, or I don't know what the full situation was with the funeral home. I just know her side of it, but there should not be a lot of reason not to be able to view. Advanced decomposition or severe destruction is one of them, but we can make someone perfectly presentable that they can identify their loved one. They're never going to look like they did in life, but they can identify them even for a private viewing. we can at least make something happen in the majority of situation, I would say.
Do you think a lot of this was going on during COVID, like here in Tennessee, they limited, when my brother-in-law lost his mother, they said 10 people or less, right? And of course, you know, we broke the rules anyway, but it was, I guess we were cycling people through more so, and maybe it was 10 people at a particular time. But do you feel like that was especially hard on families when grieving kind of took on, or at least the mourning side of this took on a whole different aspect, you know, as opposed to years prior and even things going, I guess, back to normal, you know, normal subjective, yeah. But
COVID was a really, and when I say COVID, I mean the time where we were made to have reservation on how many people were allowed and what we were allowed to do. And some funeral homes took it to extremes because they were scared. Sure. So in terms of what disposition they even offered, if someone did die of COVID, there were funeral homes who mandated they had to be cremated.
Wow.
They didn't get an option. And that was a lot out of fear. It goes back to even, you know, HIV and AIDS, the fear epidemic back in like 80s, early 90s, even a little bit. And people just not being on, you know, we were so unsure. We had no idea what was going on, no clue what this new virus was and what it would do. And people who swayed one end to the other. And so being on the funeral side, director side of it, we became the no people. And that's really hard when you're trying to connect with families and trying to meet their needs. And every single thing we have to say no to. Mom had 12 children. Sorry. Who are her favorite 10? Because they are the only ones who get to come to the funeral. How do we do that? And they started putting stricter and stricter fines and, you know, losing your license and all these things on it. So if we were caught breaking those regulations that they had put down, we could be penalized so strongly that we were almost fearful to do anything.
Wow.
But then you would meet with families, an example, like, okay, you can bring two people. That's all that can come in. You bring two people into the building to make arrangements, and they show up with three or four. Well, we all had to come. I'm sorry, only two of you. And so some of it was, hey, we're trying here, but you gotta meet us halfway. Or once the vaccine came out, people would come in who had COVID, had tested positive, would sit there with an arranger and then say, oh, well, I have COVID, but don't worry, I got my vaccine, so you're fine. And it so there was a lot of like, come on, guys, we got to respect each other. If you want me to step up, you got to step up too. So it became hard. It became just a struggle. And then you had families coming in that didn't get to be with their loved one. Then they died. Hadn't seen them in a year, except through a window at the nursing home or on FaceTime while they were at the hospital dying. And then came into the care of the funeral home. And then, sorry, you can't see them. Or sorry, you don't get to have a funeral for them. Sorry, their life meant nothing. We can't do anything now. Bye. Is how it kind of sounded, I think, to a lot of people. It was really sad to have that. And it was busy. It was, you know, at the funeral home, it was busy. And I think something that was hard was so much press about hospitals and everything, but nobody talked about the funeral home side of it, where, okay, where are those people going after they die? They got to go somewhere. What about the funeral home side? And then the only press that got was, oh, hey, this funeral home didn't do something right. Or, you know, it was always negative press rather than, hey, these funeral directors are working without PPE and using garbage bags to try to protect themselves and, you know, reusing the same mask 27 times or, you know, a lot, all the same stuff that the health professionals were dealing with, but nobody really talked about the funeral home side. And I think that got really hard for some funeral directors who were in the big thick of it. in the big epicenters like New York City or, you know, wherever. And it got challenging. And a lot of people thought, though, that after COVID, hey, you know, people are just going to start doing nothing because they saw that they could and it would be fine. But what's happened and what I've seen happen, and everybody else may have a different take, is that people are doing more because they were told for so long they don't get to do something that now when they're having secondary funerals, they're doing way more. They're doing the gathering, they're doing a viewing, they're doing more because they're seeing the value in what they didn't get to do before. That has been really cool to see as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. How things have just really changed and I guess celebrations. Do you see a difference in, you know, people calling this a funeral versus or a viewing versus a celebration of life or a funeral? Like, any thoughts on that?
Celebration of life has become kind of a cringe word almost just because it's so overused.
Yeah.
And it's been around now for 30, 40 years that people have started using it for the funeral business. But like, what does it even mean anymore? You know, we have a funeral service or we have a memorial service. We have a visitation or we have a gathering, which is a memorial gathering. Those are really the terms. There's either a body or there's no body or cremated remains. Those are the differences. So it's just learning what words, but people want to celebrate because that sounds better and is more accepting than having a funeral. But why are you celebrating? It's because a person died. Like it's trying to
polish
over and gleam over the reality of why you're having the event. And you can't really ignore the death, but only focus on the life. But that's what I think a funeral should be, is looking at a life. So every funeral really should be, you know, reflecting on this long life lived, not just a death. But that's why you're there. So some of it, I think, is trying to ignore the elephant in the room. But if it makes people feel better by calling it certain things, then so be it. I just hate when the media calls a funeral a memorial service. It's not. So they use that term a lot for, let's say, like heads of state and stuff. When you have a funeral, the casket's there. Well, the memorial today for... So there's a casket, it's a funeral, it's not a memorial. So I'm just a stickler on words, and it drives me nuts when they use them wrong. So
yeah. One of your videos, I was just like, yes, because you had stated basically the same thing about loss. I'm sorry for your loss. Like we hear that so often, and it's like, I think again, it's just, it's almost overstepping the fact that someone died here, you know, that we do have to face that part of it.
Right.
And, so I guess, you know, it does make some people feel better. When we use words that kind of, like I said, kind of polish the situation a little bit, at least in our own minds. But I think we have to recognize, you know, what has occurred here. You know, that is part of the grieving process. So,
And I always do a beginning to an obituary for people if they need a little help, rather than starting with a blank page. And I always put the person died. If they want to put and change it to went to heaven or passed away, so it's gentler, or they can embrace the thought better, or whatever it is, that's fine. But I'm going to start with the basics. The person died. They didn't really pass anywhere because I have them in front of me in the preparation room. I didn't lose them. They're right here physically, you know, kind of thing. So those two terms, I don't care for just because of my position on it, but I understand how other people, you know, look at it. You lost them in your life and you lost, but I don't know. It's loss is a better one than past. Past, I don't care for even a little bit, but
yeah,
that's
and I'm with you. And I think it's just because it is so commonly heard that sometimes I will even catch myself saying those things. And it's like, why did I just say that? You know, as opposed to something else.
Yeah.
So I will be, I don't know if you've listened to any of my other podcasts, but I'm not a fan of the five stages of grief either. I'm curious what your take is. Like, I like some other grief models a lot better, and I don't give much thought to the five stages of grief. What are your thoughts?
I don't think anything happens in a line. Nothing we go through happens in any sequential order, and everyone's grief is different. So big note, write down for yourself. Don't ever compare your loss to someone else's.
Yeah.
I don't care if you're both the same age, your kids died at the same age, like your losses are not the same. So never say, oh, I know how you feel, because you don't know how anybody feels. Everybody's different with where they're at. And I never realized how much of a swing the lost stages are. And I think that the five stages are good, because they do pop in there for most people in some ways, but it's all over the boat, or all over the page. And I think there's a million other little stages that just have no definition. And I don't think we have to define them. It's not like, okay, today I'm going to be in denial, and this is going to last for 8.5 days, and then I'm going to go on to the... No, like, you could be in denial. So I did a video on when I had a divorce a couple of years ago, and the grief after that, I could not, there was no funeral director side of me that could jump in. It was the first grief loss for me that I've ever noticed and recognized, moving in and out of phases, moving in and out of stages, and how quickly they happen. And I remember one day I was in the living room talking to my girls, and I'm laughing, and I was walking back to my office, and just from walking from the living room, like 20 feet to my office, I collapsed into the stairwell and was a hysterical, like, I thought I was going to pass out. I was crying so hard. And my girls were like, what's going on? And I'm like, just give me a minute. And I had to just sob, and it came out of nowhere. No idea. And then I carried on about my day and was task oriented. And so you just swing, and there's no logic. And some of it happens, I think, when there's triggers, and you can't control triggers. You go to the grocery store and you see a food that was your person's favorite, or you go to text them and say, hey, do we have milk at home? Or it could be any little bitty thing, and it just triggers either anger or hysteria or just sadness, and it puts you in a funk. And I think some people think that you have to be an emotional wreck to be grieving. But it could be anger, because you could be angry that the person's gone, and there's nobody to be mad about it. Like, you can't be mad at them. You can't be mad at, there's not always somebody. It's hard to be mad at cancer. It's not this thing in front of you that you can punch. It's hard to be mad about certain deaths, because there's no one there to physically be mad at. And I think that's a hard part of it, is you can't, it's hard to work through being angry at something it's invisible. And so it's like, how do you even do that? So I think that was my foray into grief. And people are like, well, why are you even sharing this? And I'm like, because this is my only connection to what people are feeling that I'm meeting with, is going through a loss that I can't protect myself from. Any death, I can protect myself because of the mechanisms I have built in me as a funeral director. But this divorce and all the things that I am walking away from and losing, and leaving this house, leaving all my friends in this community, leaving relationships, leaving all these things, that is a loss that I can't protect myself from. I am physically losing them. And they didn't die, but I'm still grieving that they are going to be absent from my everyday, and that my world changes. And it's just what it is. So I think I have no idea if I've answered what you've asked me.
No, it's really interesting to hear you say this, because 2 years ago, I wrote a book about divorce. Okay. It was a divorce workbook.
Yeah.
And my parents, they divorced when I was age 15. I swore I would never go through a divorce, went off to the Navy, came back, had a kid, and went through a divorce myself. So it's interesting that I have the tools and maybe, I don't know if I should use the word desensitized to divorce, but at least enough to help so many people. I taught a divorce class for probably 14 years before I ever became a therapist. It's just, it's what I know, you know, and here you're called to do something else where I may fall apart, you know, and again, I don't know if desensitized is the right word, but I do believe we both have callings, right? And this obviously is your calling to help people through a very, very difficult time where most people probably would fall apart. But yeah. It's interesting to hear you say that, you know, I'm not untouchable. I do have areas of life where I grieve differently than others. So excellent, excellent point.
Well, and I think too, when you have kids going through a divorce or walking with them through a death, after a death, is also very different. And I learned, I never realized some of the compounded or double grief, as I call it. I don't even know if that's a word, but I did a video on it. So after my niece died, I sat on a panel with my mom for a hospice workshop thing. And I never realized that as a parent, when your child loses a child, you know, you're grieving and processing the loss for yourself of your grandchild, but you are also watching your child, and I get choked up every time I talk about it. You're watching your child go through a pain that you can't protect them from. And I think in the divorce, it was the same thing. For the first time, I could recognize that my kids, these little girls, are going through this thing that they don't know how to process. They're trying to work through. They're, you know, we're trying our best as parents. We have no idea if we're doing it right or wrong, but we're doing our best. And you go through something and you are trying to take care of yourself, but you're also trying to take care of your children who are going through this, you know, magnanimous event in their life as well. And so that has helped me so much, meeting with families where there is a grandparent child, and then the other child has, you know, their child has died, where the grandparents often step in and are helping a lot. And so we talk, me and the grandparents, a good deal, and letting them know this, I'm sure this is hard because you're having to watch your child go through this along with losing your grandchild. And they're like, oh my God, you get it. And I'm like, I do, just because I've learned and understood that there's this compounded or double grief that you're kind of going through in these two areas. And I think that's was hard as well through the divorce, is watching your child have to go through these emotions they don't know quite always how to go through. And yeah, it's a tough thing to have to do that.
I've got a couple of more questions I wanted to make sure that I get in. And one of them is, I see the way people grieve so differently, or we'll say mourn differently, at funerals. Mm-hmm. Has there been one that just stood out that, wow, this is really, really unique?
You know, we get the casket crawlers, not as often as you would think. I haven't seen that in a few
years. Explain that, because I know what you're talking about, but there may be some who don't.
Yeah, it's more common in certain cultures where people are far more outwardly emotional than others, where people try to physically crawl into the casket. So exactly as it's called, a casket crawler. Not so much they want to go be buried with the person. It's not that they want to die too. Well, sometimes they do. You know, I want to go with them. But they just want to physically be closer to the person. And I get that. But, you know, we can't have them getting in and pouncing on a deceased person and rocking the casket and everything. So there are situations like that, which is not totally abnormal, but definitely different if you've never witnessed it.
Let me jump in real quick there. Not that I'm suggesting this show for everyone, but I think it's in probably the first three or four episodes of 6 Feet Under where two funeral directors are talking and they're like, there's a casket crawler right there. I know it's going to happen. And sure enough.
Known. Yeah. I'm trying to think which, because I'm doing a rewatcher series on 6 Feet Under, and we're just, this week we record the last episode of the first season, and I'm trying to remember which, and I think it was the, are they Italian or something? And he falls into the like mixer blade thing at the factory.
The dough. Yeah. That's
the
in
dough mixer. I feel like that might be the one, and they're standing there and they're like, I think we got her. Oh, yep. She's going to go.
And that's she, it. That's
they
it.
They don't call her a casket crawler. They call her something else, but it's yep, the same thing. And you can spot them because they're sly and they get in there. And yeah, so there's that. But I would say I have two funerals that I just broke my heart more than anything else. And I've never seen so much loss, pain, emotion as these two funerals. One was a fiance of a young woman who was raped and murdered, and just he came in and the pain that you could see on him, in him, emoted through the sounds that he made, just tore anybody apart that was there. Like, it just was the pain. You felt it. I would say that's probably one of the most emotional people I've ever seen. And I buried a baby, and the baby was at the funeral home for a couple days. You know, once the baby was ready, I try and get babies up and viewable pretty quickly, because the family typically wants to come in a couple times to sit and hold the baby and just spend time. And they had a little girl who I couldn't tell you exactly the age. She was like 3 or 4 or something like that. Too young to fully understand, but old enough to talk and, you know, be able to talk to and explain a few things, even though she didn't fully get it. And so she would come and see baby and spend some time. And we had the viewing, we had the funeral and everything. We went to the cemetery. Another one that just chokes me up every time I think about it. And we were at the cemetery and everything was done and she had to go get in her car. Well, at the funeral home, she was at a house. It looked like a house, had furniture, there's carpet, there's bathrooms. It's a bit, you know, she was visiting her baby at a house. Now she was being told to leave her baby there. The emotion that child emitted at that moment was pain. Oh, it was terrible, because she realized she was leaving that baby at that cemetery. Whether she remembered it after that day or not as being final, that moment that set in for her was, oh my God, it was terrible. So some of those just moments where you really feel somebody's pain is to me the most mourning. You get people kind of crying or wailing once in a while. People putting stuff in the casket, things like that, but nothing too wild. Sometimes some fighting at the cemetery. The cemetery is really, people are always like, do people fight a lot? Do people, you know, like, what do you get to see? And I'm like, people usually get along until the body is gone. So until the service, until the cemetery, and it's after that, that all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
And I saw these two women, and it was weird because one was a stepmom and one was a daughter or something like that. Like, it was a weird dynamic, and they were kissing the casket and they wanted to be the last one to kiss the casket, but the one would do it and then the other would sneak in and do it again. So then she would sneak in and do it again, and they'd get like shoving each other, and then they'd pull, other people would pull them apart, and then they would get doing it again. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, come on guys. Let's like somebody else just come in and kiss the casket and call it good. You know, because it went on. It seemed like it went on forever. But you get these weird, wacky little moments. And, you know, they say grief doesn't set in until 2 weeks after a death. That's what a lot of literature says and a lot of kind of studies, because your brain is in response mode. You're protecting yourself. Things are not fully getting in because your body won't let you absorb everything that's happening. I read studies once about how we physically and mentally were never made to understand and withstand death, like the of someone around us. We just mentally and physically and everything cannot take it in, because it's, how do you understand something until you go through it? Well, I can't understand death until I have died, and then it's kind of too late to live with it. So it's not something we can fully embrace. And so during the whole funeral process, we typically have people in our care in the fog period still. And it's after it's all finite, after they have to start waking up without that person there and nothing tasked to do, like go to the funeral home, deliver the clothing, bring us a picture. During that phase, they're tasked and they can put one foot in front of the other doing something for this funeral. Whereas after that, when everybody's gone back to work, they're waking up having to do what? You know, go back to a normal life. Well, no life is normal again. They have to rebuild whatever their life is into the new version. But who's to tell them what that is? And how do you do that? And so that's kind of when grief really, really settles in. That's when you really begin your grief journey. So there's people who will be like, well, to be done with my grief, I really do need that. I need to view them and then I'll be fine. And it's like, well, I'm not going to tell you that it's just starting. Talk to you in a couple weeks, you know, kind of thing, because there's all this that comes later with all of it. And I'm not a psychologist, but I just know from kind of being around and seeing people and seeing the fog and knowing a month later when you talk to them, they're like, yeah, this is when it's the hardest right now.
That's a great segue into one of the other questions I wanted to make sure that I attended
to. How
good
I am. Yeah, it's like,
yeah, thank you. You read my mind.
Up.
So what resources do you give people, and at what point do you give them those resources?
I am not passing on much at the funeral home I'm at now. It's typically the grief coordinator, the aftercare person that will provide information. Care notes is a big one that funeral homes use. There are these little booklets that are relationships or situational specific, and they give just a little booklet of information. A lot of funeral homes will have a list of local grief support, widow groups, things like that, where people can meet and reach out. Depending on the scenario, I may guide people to information if they have children. Sesame Street has an amazing program for helping explain loss and death to children. So does Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, where Bluefish dies. So there's a lot of good things for children that you can open the conversation with. So that side of it, I will try to help a little more by providing kind of resources for them, but I leave some of the other up to other people. And if I see someone struggling where they've been in a whole bunch of times, I'll ask them, you know, do you want me to find somebody you can talk to? I'm not a therapist, so coming back and meeting with me 6 more times, I understand that you kind of connected with me during the funeral, but that's not, you know, I'm not a professional on that side. And I'd like to help you find somebody to talk to or whatnot. And it's nice, those groups, people can find somebody else that's maybe in a similar situation to make a coffee date with or connect with, or sometimes just letting someone know that it's okay where they're at and what they're doing. But if someone comes back a year later and they seem to be still in that same spot, that's when you really have to try to urge them to get some help, because there's no time limit on when you're okay, in air quotes here, but that you are functioning and trying to establish a new role. But if you see somebody who is still not back to work after a year, still kind of stuck, that's when maybe you should be concerned. So if your friend or family are still seeming to be stuck after a year and not making any moves forward, then, you know, trying to help them, trying to go offer to go with them. Hey, do you want me to go with you to a support group? I know at one time I thought, and it was a couple of years after my niece was killed, and I thought, gosh, I need to talk to somebody. Like I need some help. There are no support groups for aunts and uncles. Let me tell you, there's nothing. There's nothing for these extra ancillary roles. I think that's the right word. For a relationship. So I was really frustrated by that I couldn't find a support group that met my need anywhere near me, because there was no like generic kind of thing. It was like for parents or widows or something where it wasn't the fit for my situation. And that was hard. That was a challenge.
That falls into what's called disenfranchised grief, right? That my grief doesn't fit the societal norm. And right. Being an aunt or uncle, you know, it definitely falls into that category for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, every aunt and uncle is not as close to a niece or nephew. She was the only child in our family. You know, at the point I was not married, my brother was not married, my sister was divorced and had this one child. And so it was just my parents, the three of us, and this child. And we spent a lot of time together. And so losing her was not just like, oh, I have 20 nieces and nephews and I lost one. It was a very special, I think, role where, and having gone through, done what I did through the process, embalming her and dressing her and getting her ready and making sure all the funeral stuff was in, that's a very specific role I had. And there's no support group for that. You know, there's no Hallmark card, as they say. There's no specific. So I did do some therapy, but I've had some really poopy therapists as well along the years. And so that's always been a challenge too, is trying to find the right one.
Yes.
Make time for therapy, but finding the right therapist for you. I had a therapist told me, I told my children I loved them too much. I was like, really? Is that a thing? You know, I had a therapist first. We had just sat down, got to meet each other. She goes, so who abused you when you were a child? And I was like, what?
Wow.
Like, how is this your first question to me? I'm like, are we on like some reality weird show or something?
Yeah. So check, please.
Yeah. It was not good. So, you know, always keep searching for somebody that fits your needs and who works with you. And some people don't like, I love that you can do virtual now. It makes it so much more accommodating for some, you know, some people like the in-person, but when you're super busy, you can make it fit your needs when it's maybe a little less, what's that word? It doesn't stress you out as much to have to go to a therapist's office and walk in and then sit on a couch. You can sit in your own space where you're most comfortable to be able to share. And I think that's really nice with the virtual. Same with, you know, you talked earlier about mortuary school. There's so many virtual mortuary schools.
Really?
Oh, yep. A lot of them. So the one I teach for is all virtual. So the programs are a little different, obviously. But yeah, there's a lot of virtual mortuary schools. So
I would not have thought.
Yeah. Just because there are so few for people that it's a big career for second careers. And so you have 40, 50 year old people who are very established with their family, their children, and they can't just uproot everybody to go off to school 2-3 hours away. They can do it virtual, still maintain and work, even just a part-time to contribute to the family while attending school and in doing all of it. So it is a nice way to accommodate just our changing roles that we're all in. It's not just 20-year-olds, you know, that are headed off to school or anything. Mortuary school right now is 70 to 80% women, and it is high percentage of first generation. So it's not just funeral director kids going off to school just to get their license to go back and run the funeral home anymore. It is first generation. Many have never worked in a funeral home. So it is a very different group of people going to mortuary school now.
Wow. Which is
super interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That is very interesting. Well, Carrie, I know we're here at our hour, you know, that I told you that we would use, and we're a little over anyway, but I don't care. You just tell me, like, what are we missing? Anything you want to talk about?
Did we answer all your questions? Did we get all yours?
Honestly, I could probably do 3 or 4 episodes with you. Honestly, this is so interesting to me. And I'm sure that, it is interesting to other people. Yeah. And it is quite different than previous episodes. Yeah, I've got thousands of questions, but you know, I always try to respect people's time, and, I don't know.
What? We can always do another episode too. I'm happy to come back again. Did you ask everything you wanted to about like my niece and all of that with it? I know you had watched, I just had put out a video and then social media clips of my top 7 things we learned when my niece died. That was one thing I kind of cycled back to the story. My 100th episode of my channel on YouTube was telling the story of her death. And I mean, I'm at 900 episodes or something, or videos at this point. So that was 800 videos ago, which was crazy. And I really haven't talked about her death since. And I've always had this list of things we learned, things that, you know, just as people going through a loss that maybe each of us as a family felt or saw or understood or learned. And so that was kind of my initial 7 things. And it was nice to be able to share them and kind of talk about her a little bit. And I asked my sister first, I said, hey, do you have any objection to this? And some people are like, well, what, you should interview your sister. And I'm like, she would probably do it just for me, but then I don't want to put her in that position to ask her about her law, you know, her losing my niece and her death and stuff. And so it's like, I don't want to ask that of her. I feel like that's a double-edged sword question sort of thing, a tricky question to ask.
Well, Carrie, I will just formally invite your sister, if she would ever want to be on the podcast, to tell her side of grief, you know, and like you had stated earlier, we all grieve differently, even though you're grieving the same person. Wow. What a different story she would have to tell, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And we have so many moments through all of that, that gosh, we got laughing so hard, and we would have these just stupid slap happy moments. And, but at the 1 year of her death, that was, so talking about that. So when you get to that 1 year, that's usually the hardest for a lot of people, they say, is that 1 year mark. You've gone through all the holidays. You've gone through all the big moments that you're not having your person there with you. And you get to that 1 year and it's like, okay, now what? I've done all the firsts. Now what? Like, now do we go into a new phase of this? Like, what happens? And so we got to that 1 year mark, and the day of was me walking through the steps of what had happened a year prior. And that's what I did. Okay, 1 year ago, where was I? Okay, 1 year ago, what was I doing? And I talked to my sister and I said, I'm just going back to what we were doing a year ago. And she goes, yeah, I'm not. And I said, well, what? And she said, I'm not thinking about that. Like, I'm thinking about her. I'm thinking about things I did with her, but I don't want to put a lot of emphasis into that day and what happened. She said, I am not celebrating that day. I am not mourning that day, kind of thing. She said, her birthday, that's when I will, you know, think about her and do something on that day and everything. She said, but I don't want to give him kind of the power of us being taken back to that every year. And I'm like, oh, I am, you know, that was me. And that was my mind. And I think because walking through it, I think I was hoping that maybe I would feel more, I would be I don't know, maybe something would change in my mind and it would be, I don't know, I would immerse in it more and I would let myself feel through some things more, and it just never happened. It never, and I always think, what could I have done better? What would I have done different? Should I have this? Should I have that? And, you know, that's, it's not like anything can ever be redone when it comes to funerals. You can always get married again. You can have another funeral or a new wedding day. You can't, you could have another funeral, but it's not like you're going to dig up, have the funeral and then rebury or recremate or whatever it may be. Like, it's really a one-time event that you're having. That's why the importance of don't mess this up is there for a funeral director, because it's really a one-time event. Mm-hmm. You don't get to redo. You don't get to like rewind. And so I think about that and like, what would I have, should I have done better, different, any of it? And I don't know. I don't know.
And of course, that's where the therapist side of me comes in and says, you know, those are all guilt words, right?
They are.
The shoulda, woulda, couldas. And maybe it happened the way exactly it was supposed to happen, right?
Exactly. And that's, you know, where if one little thing had changed, what would that have, you know, the trickle effect or the ripple effect, what else would have been changed because of that one? And so, you know, things play out the way they do. That's why I say I don't have a lot of regret in life, because if I had not done this, then what would have happened? If I had not gone to that school, what would have happened? If I had not dated that guy, what would have happened? Or, you know, it's hard to have those regrets because we are where we are because of all the actions we take. And so would you be somewhere better, somewhere worse? Who's to say? You just don't know. I think that only regret is not seeing him, because I think that has caused me more, not turmoil, but more question over the years than necessary. But I don't know how I would have seen him unless I went to the funeral. I do know somebody that was at the funeral, and they said that, you know, they reported back that it was for sure him. And so, you know, that's a good thing. I've gone to his headstone after. I've drove through the town and I have visited his grave twice.
Yeah, there was something interesting about the headstone.
Yeah, so I went to the office at that cemetery and they kind of guided me to where his headstone was. And I walked up and her name was at the bottom of the headstone with little, I think there's a butterfly next to it. And it just caught me really off guard, because so I see the vantage point that maybe the grandparents wanted to kind of reflect on her, but I think it was also some ignorance on their part that their son was a murderer and had taken her life. So I think that shouldn't be allowed. If they wanted to do something for her, they could have put a separate stone, not them together on a stone kind of thing. And so I just thought that was really in poor taste that they did that and that they'd be allowed to do that. You know, he never had to stand trial and publicly be, you know, scrutinized for what he did. And that would have been horrific to have to go through a trial anyway, but it just doesn't seem fair that that could be allowed. And it's funny because on the other side of it, I've done videos about people should get to grieve their loved ones, whether they were a criminal or not in the end. You know, they weren't always that way. There was a gentleman out west somewhere who killed his whole family, the wife and kids and stuff. And the family put this obituary out that was like, he was a wonderful man, he was a wonderful father, and blah, blah, blah. Well, to them, that's who he was until the act. And so I completely see that side of it as well, that you want to maintain and hold on to who that person was, that you knew. You don't want to remember your loved one as a criminal. You don't want to remember them as a murderer. There's somebody who always says that everyone was a glimmer in someone's eye. Mm. You know, there were that little kid running around in the backyard and blowing bubbles and giving you kisses and giving you a bath when you were a baby kind of thing, and making all these great memories. And so they should get to grieve and have support for that loss and stuff. But I just think, you know, that is almost too far to be able to be allowed to do. So I kind of contradict myself a little that I think it's okay to do one and not the other. But I think an obituary is done in the haste and initial response reaction of a death and of processing things. And then you're ordering your stone down the road. Like, that's not happening immediately. So you're doing your stone with a clearer mind, with conscious choice. And I think it just, knowing them and how they are ignorant as people, and I'm okay to say that because I know how they raised him and some of what happened there. But I think it just shows a severe lack of how they want to be represented, not about, oh, we want to honor her and stuff. I think it was more about them wanting to feel a certain way and stuff. So I don't know. It's gotten some definite both side reaction on some of my posts about that one, just because people are like, well, the grandparents are grieving too. Yeah, they are in some way, but I think they're in severe denial of who their child was. And I think, I won't say much more, but But I also wanted to buy the grave space next to his and put up a monument that had an arrow that said, here lies some really, you know, very true statements, but I don't know that that would have been allowed. So.
Yeah. That's, it is a double-edged sword. You know, I want to be able to, say what I want, but I don't want others to be able to say things either. You know, it's, I get that. I do, though. And I certainly see, you know, I've got a daughter and I can't imagine her life being taken by someone and how I would respond. You know, I have no idea.
I can't imagine. It's, you know, having daughters now after all of that and imagining anything ever bad happening to them, I cannot fathom. And I've seen my sister, you know, just from what I've seen of her life after and how she's kind of gone through, but so much has been in private and on her own, and she's dove into her faith. And that has been, I think, a big thing that has gotten her into the next stage of her life and kind of carrying on and establishing a new life without her child here. And so I think everybody kind of does their own thing, and we never will ever understand fully what someone else goes through, and shouldn't act like we can understand. Yeah. So,
Carrie, I thank you very much. And I really do. The invitation is open. I'd love to do this again. It's been a very, very interesting podcast, and I'm sure that people will learn a lot. And any final thoughts from just closing this out on this episode?
No, I think my role is always ever evolving, and I'm very driven by consumer and interest and intrigue by what people are interested in learning about. So, you know, I always thought when I started the YouTube, it was just kind of happenstance. It just kind of started, and I thought, oh, it'll fizzle out after a little bit. But I have pages and lists of videos people want, and there's just not enough time in the day to record what people want to know about or see or anything. And so I think it just really shows how interested in death care people are and in what we do at the funeral home and in all these different areas, and curious, but yet want to do it from a safe space. You know, where they're not going to go walk into a funeral home and ask a question, but they can ask somebody online. They can view kind of some things online, but be cautious who you're following, what you're watching, understand if they're actually a funeral professional or not, because anybody can put mortician or funeral director or whatever in their name. And I know there's a lot of people on social media that are pre-mortuary students or just students. They've never actually worked in a funeral home. They are talking about things for clicks or for views or for followers, that maybe someone is licensed but hasn't worked in a funeral home for years or barely ever worked in one. And so they're not sharing knowledge based off of much experience at all. So just be cautious who you're following and getting educated from. Make sure they are legit. Make sure they have experience behind what they are saying and sharing, because you don't want bad advice and you don't want to be misguided. And social media is not law. It's not overseen by anyone telling you what the actual facts are. Anybody can post anything. So just be really cautious what you're following in any capacity, but, you know, especially when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah, that's good advice, because I had reached out to several embalmers, funeral directors, morticians, and I really only had two, including yourself, to really reach back out to me. And it did make me wonder in a lot of ways, like who is legit, you know? And like you stated, there's so many people out there just looking for followers. And of course, as a podcaster, as my side gig here, I will say there's like no money, unless you're like Joe Rogan status or something. Yeah. There's no money in podcasting. So I really do have the heart to help others. And I hope people in, I don't want to say the limelight, but, you know, people who are doing this do it for the right reasons. Right. And I certainly appreciate your take and just your honesty and sincerity that I see through your videos. And it's not that you don't have a couple of fun videos in there too, you know. It's and I think that is important. Just like you said, there is a time to laugh, there's a time to cry, but I don't know. I appreciate the way you do it, and
thank you.
Can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to be here with me. And I'm certain that many listeners will take away a lot of good nuggets from this. So
if anybody has questions, you're welcome to email me, Carrie@carriethemortician.com. I respond to every email, try and do it pretty timely. And so make sure you reach out if you do have questions.
All right. Well, I will have her email in the show description, as well as her YouTube, Facebook, and her website information. So feel free to reach out to her. And if you want to be on the show, just as Carrie was today, feel free to send me an email at griefobservedpodcast@gmail.com or catch up with me on my Facebook page. Thanks again for listening, and we will catch you on the next episode. Take care, everybody.